This is a rebroadcast of a show we aired in February. In this segment, we talk about the future.
Brooke, now that we are in the future, how do you feel?
I feel enhanced and augmented. I have access to so much information in all of its breadth and depth, and I am connected with more than a million friends, both on Earth and the Moon. Also, Huffington Post goes directly to my brain.
Wait, let me Google you. In 2014, Gawker called you a slut. There is a picture of you, too, from 2016. You look drunk.
I wasn't drunk. That picture was taken the day a hacker got all the world's passwords and drained my bank account.
That was a bad year. In August, I beat Deep Blue in chess, but in September, Watson beat me in basketball and ran off with my wife.
Watson is smarter than you.
He also has an excellent jump shot and a better radio voice. I do not care for the future.
I like the future. My only complaint is my iPhone is still dropping calls.
This is On the Media Live. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The future is unknown. The unknown is scary. Therefore, futuristic fiction, science fiction, is generally terrifying.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
All right, listen. The Terminator's an infiltration unit. Part man, part machine. Underneath, it's a hyperalloy combat chassis. Very tough.
What is the Matrix? Control. The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world. Built to keep us under control. In order to change a human being into this.
Awesome. In general, science fiction offers us two distinct trends for the future and how we'll interact with it. One is that we'll be integrated into the machine. I'll be a partly hyperalloy combat chassis.
With a heart of gold.
Let's call that the Terminator track.
All right. I'll take the other track, my track, when computer intelligence, artificial intelligence, surpasses human intelligence. Computers are improving at an exponential rate, but they still trip over even one of the simplest human tricks, our ability to talk to each other. So, like, when I say, edited by Brooke, there's meaning there that a computer just can't understand, right?
Actually, I don't think anybody understands that much.
The point is, computers can't understand puns, metaphors, wordplay, or sarcasm, much less pregnant pauses. That kind of semantic understanding has been a holy grail for computer engineers.
Computers are used to unambiguous things. Human language, completely the opposite. Last night, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How it got in my pajamas, I'll never know. We know what the pajamas are modifying, but the computer, it's just as likely that the elephant's wearing pajamas.
That's where computers struggle dramatically, and that's where we want to make them better.
And it's finally happening, Brooke. This week, pretty much right this minute, actually, on Jeopardy, an IBM computer called Watson is taking on human opponents.
Olympic oddities for $600.
A 1976 entrant in the modern this was kicked out for wiring his epee to score points without touching his foe. Watson.
What is pentathlon?
Yes.
Name the decade for $600.
Klaus Barbie is sentenced to life in prison, and DNA is first used to convict a criminal. Ken.
I don't know. What is the 1980s?
Yes, that's it.
Olympic oddities for $1,000.
It was the anatomical oddity of U.S. gymnast George Iser, who won a gold medal on the parallel bars in 1904. Watson?
What is leg?
No.
Brad? What is he's missing a leg?
Yeah,
wow. They make Alex Trebek look so human.
And he's even condescending to robots.
So if that's the holy grail, real language, how does he do it?
Well, For starters, Watson knows a lot of stuff. Not because he's connected to the internet. He isn't. It's only got what's been fed into it. Just like his human competitors. Engineers have entered all kinds of information. They've just scanned it in with 2,500 processor cores, whatever they are, humming along at up to 33 billion operations a second. So there's that. But Clive Thompson, the technology journalist OTM so depends on, says that shoveling info into Watson is really just the beginning.
Here's a way of thinking about it. You could take, say, an article I wrote for the New York Times, and you could input that into Watson. And by the time Watson has finished analyzing it and adding layers of meaning to help it figure out what that thing stands for and how to match it to other documents to find similarity between a question that you might ask to Watson, by the time it's done with all that, there will be 10 times as much data stacked on top of that story as the original story is in length. So if you're to look inside Watson's brain, only 10% of it is the enormous amount of raw text that they have fed into Watson. The other 90% is stuff that Watson has added on top of it, saying, you know, what are the main keywords in this article, you know, to help figure out the meaning? You know, how statistically similar is it to all the other things I know? So it does a lot of meta-thinking on top of that document.
Okay, but I still don't quite understand how Watson thinks. I mean, Watson saw this clue. This hat is elementary, my dear Watson, and came up with, what is a deerstalker hat? Mm-hmm. And how did he do that?
Oh. that's an excellent question.
You don't know, do you?
I have absolutely no idea. No, but I do know what Watson reminds me of.
Computer, last message received and recorded from Captain Kirk.
In place.
Run it through analyzer. Question, is it or is it not the captain's voice?
Negative. Up close, copy.
A voice duplicator?
98% probability.
Well, they've got them, Doctor. And now they're trying to get us.
Can we just watch this for a while?
That ridiculous clip from like 1966 foreshadows what computer scientists call the semantic web. Clive says that the Star Trek computer was kind of a proto-Watson.
And in some respects, that is the paradigm that the IBM guys started with. They actually were sitting around thinking, when are we going to get to the Star Trek point? When are we going to get to the point where we can simply just ask the computer a question in regular English and have the computer answer it?
Now, again, Watson happens not to be connected online, but his software is a step toward the so-called semantic web, the bridge between the Google that searches for keywords and a computer that can just talk to us and really understand us. That is a huge step on the path towards true artificial intelligence.
And so if Watson wins Jeopardy, we're getting artificial intelligence. What happens when Watson becomes conscious, when it becomes willful, when it becomes Hal?
Hal is a Watson has no volition, evil or otherwise. It's just a rather remarkably evolved tool. Think of Deep Blue. That was the computer that IBM finished 14 years ago to challenge a grandmaster in chess, remember? Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, but it did not, you know, go on to refuse to open the pod bay doors. What it did do was show Kasparov how to get better at chess. He, in fact, helped stage a second competition in which man and ordinary personal computer teamed up against the supercomputer Deep Blue. Here's Clive.
You could get a grandmaster with a cheap chess program, and they could be a better chess player than Deep Blue. In fact, it even got weirder than that, because at the end of the first advanced chess competition, the winning team wasn't even a grandmaster. It was a comparative amateur at chess.
So maybe the analogy isn't Hal. Maybe the analogy is like the bionic man.
Yeah, exactly. The future of computers and humans and intelligence isn't going to be Hal. It's going to be Steve Austin, you know, the bionic man, the guy who's intelligent assistance from machinery makes him more powerful than the average person.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him.
We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better, stronger, faster.
Better, stronger, faster, and doggone it, people like him.
You know, Bob, we already have some of this technology. I mean, right now you can hold up your iPhone, if you have the right app, to any building or monument or product and find out everything you need to know through the eyes of the internet. They call it Google Eyes, and you can get them. A few years down the line, we could have the Terminator's eyes.
The contact lenses that we have at the moment are very rudimentary. Basically, what we have is contact lenses that have small antennas and small radios integrated into their structure. The radio waves convert some of it to usable energy for the circuitry, and very recently we've been able to turn on very, very basic text on the contact lens.
That's Babak Parviz. He's an associate professor of bio-nanotechnology and nanofabrication at the University of Washington. Here's what I asked him. Would you like to be able to access through your eyes face recognition technology and Google searches and so forth so that somebody standing next to you on the subway becomes fully knowable?
I think that will definitely happen. You have your normal vision, but superimposed on that, you have some more data. Could be a search result or result of a face recognition program or a GPS that is telling you where to go.
Can I go back to dystopia for a second? That's cool. But being able to see what we want to see superimposed onto the actual world, doesn't that allow us to filter out what we dislike? Like in my case, Glenn Beck and the New York Yankees. Do we really want to put on high-tech blinders?
High-tech blinders worried me too. So I asked Jaime Cassio about it. He works at the Institute for the Future. You're walking down the street and you see somebody who supports a position you don't like, and you've adjusted your augmented reality glasses so that a little black dot covers up their face?
Right. You don't want to make them invisible, which eventually you might be able to have technology that could do that, because you don't want to run into them, of course. But you want to have some way of identifying, this is someone whose political or social positions I find abhorrent, and I don't want to accidentally run into them and engage them in conversation. As with every technology we develop, there are inevitably negative, surprising consequences that emerge alongside the broad social benefits.
Mm-hmm. So contact lenses don't obliterate people. People obliterate people.
Well, when you put it that way, it seems kind of trite. But I will fall back on my general theory that all this technology makes us only more of what we were going to be anyway. And really, contact lenses like this are just a toy compared to what inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil thinks we have in store. In this clip from this film about Kurzweil, Transcendent Man, he remembers that in 1965, the computer at MIT took up a large part of a building, and look how far we've come.
Speak to young people, teenagers, and even in their lifetimes, they can see how much more quickly technology moves today than it did 5 years ago. The nature of technological progress is exponential. If I count linearly 30 steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I get to 30. If I count exponentially 2, 4, 8, 16, 30 steps later, I'm at a billion. It makes a dramatic difference. So we went from a building to something that fits in your pocket in 40 years, and the next 25 years we'll go from something that fits in your pocket to something that's the size of a blood cell.
He believes in a concept he calls the singularity, where technological progress becomes so rapid it will erase the lines between AI, human consciousness, biology, and technology. We'll be omniscient and immortal. And he already has a hard date for when this will occur, the singularity. He says it will happen in 2042. That's right, Bob. When I'm 65 and you're 92, we'll hit the next evolutionary landmark together. And human intelligence will multiply a billionfold. People will no longer surf the web. They will be the web.
The internet are us, eh? Maybe. On the other hand, Jaron Lanier, one of the pioneers of virtual reality, says that singularity is a pipe dream.
The singularity is a mass fantasy of certain kinds of nerdy people that allows them to not take responsibility and to pretend that technology is running the show so that they can just be along for the ride. The obvious parallel to draw is to certain religious ideas that the world's going to end and that some people that are here today are just sort of obsolete. And I'm thinking of the idea of the rapture that you find in the American evangelical community, this notion that there's going to be this event where some people disappear and the ones who were left are the ones who didn't get it or something. So it's entirely based on faith.
Brooke, I'm going to stop right here. It seems to me that this gets to the whole point of tonight's discussion. Because I know Kurzweil is fine with the rapture comparison. He believes the desire to transcend our earthly selves is entirely human. It's just that he thinks it's no pipe dream. He believes that we'll have the technology.
Right. And Lanier doesn't condemn technology's march. He just says that we need to be conscious of the implications every step of the way. He says that being human is still such a profound mystery that we shouldn't be rushing off into the new technology before we plumb that mystery.
And Kurzweil says that humanity is a moving target, not a problem to be solved, but a process that we need to embrace.
And Lanier says when we go online, we compromise our full humanity and we trim ourselves to fit the narrow categories of Facebook or the character constraints of Twitter.
But Kurzweil says that all those limitations will be erased with technology's exponential growth. We may be bionic. We may navigate a virtual world hand in hand with artificial intelligence, but we will still, always will, have a responsibility to other human beings.
So, as we speak, Watson may be winning tonight's competition. Computers are gradually getting to be more like us. I guess it's up to us to decide whether or not that'll actually be an improvement.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for mulling it over with us. That's it for this week's show on the Media. It was produced by Jamie York, Mike Fuolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sara Abdurrahman, with more help from Andrew Parsons, Carlin Gallietti, Ricardo Fernandez, Eric Kamens, Nikki Johnson, and Amy Pearl. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were John Delore and Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Wait, let me check the script. And I'm Bob Garfield. Thank you very much.